I'd like to thank John Bernard for inviting me to speak to you this afternoon. This is a tougher audience in many respects to speak to because there's, as I've traveled around North America giving this talk, I've talked to a very wide range of people involved in optical systems of various sorts. But here there's more of the original work and people who have expertise. So hopefully you won't ask me too many questions that I'll have to do a tap dance to answer. What I'm going to talk about today is basically part of the problem in making semiconductor lasers suitable for integration. There's lots of aspects of photonics, and I should say that I'm not talking about optoelectronics. Optoelectronics, I don't know if there's any general definition of the term, but optoelectronics in my mind includes all of those devices where there is some photonics, but there also might be substantial electronics. But for photonic devices, where we're talking about processing, shaping, and moving information with the optical beam, the levels of integration are basically very small. You know, you might buy a Pentium II chip today for your computer, and it'll have maybe 100,000 transistors in there. But the number of optical components chained together in a monolithic sense is much, much smaller than that, numbers of 2 and 3 and so on. And there's some very important reasons for that, and what I'm going to do is talk about two of them specifically. The first is the concept or the problem associated with epitaxial layer structure optimization. When you make an electronic device in a silicon, you do a couple of diffusions, 2 or 3 diffusions, or you make some gates, and you can replicate this as much as you want. Your problem becomes complicated by interconnecting them. When we talk about making a laser and a modulator and a waveguide and a detector, a splitter, most of these structures, when separately optimized, look very different. And so the problem becomes hooking these things together, recognizing that the epitaxial layer growth is a substantial part of the problem. The second part is the kind of resonator. All lasers require an energy source, a gain medium, and some kind of a high Q resonator so that there's feedback. It is an oscillator after all. And that's been done for decades by making cleave facets. And they are not, there's some very difficult problems associated with using that in a monolithic integrated kind of structure. So with that said, my talk is going to talk engineering in the optical path, specifically about selective area epitaxy. I'm going to talk about an approach that we think has great promise as an integrable laser resonator. I'm going to talk about a couple of different examples that, that draw from these technologies to at least show how some things can be coupled together to get some increased functionality, and then briefly summarize. There have been a number of approaches to this wafer engineering problem in the past, one of which is the universal substrate. And the idea here is that you find some compromised epitaxial layer structure that you can just grow one time. And it might not be the best structure for a laser or a photodetector or a modulator, but it'll make a passable structure for any of the devices that you might want to make. And the argument being that the sum is greater than the parts, and you can get to an integrated device even though you're making these compromises. Another approach is to use variations on regrowth, overgrowth, multiple growth, and an example of that is this drawing from a tutorial that Tom Koch gave at OFC some years ago. This is this is an interesting approach, and it solves that problem because now you can separately optimize lasers and so on, but it's not particularly easy to do. The idea here is that you'll grow your laser structure and then etch that away where you don't need it, and then return and grow another structure. You see this is a phase shift region in the middle there. You might include some processing like the grating for a DFB laser in there, and then regrow that and then etch another place. The regrowth can be a problem. I'm convinced that regrowth is not a big problem. There's lots of examples why regrowth now is becoming more an acceptable technology. For example, about half of the CD-ROM lasers manufactured every year now involve a regrowth step. And it seems to, you know, when you all are replacing your CDs, it's not because the laser failed. But there are, for coupling light in this sense, there are some other problems. Doing this regrowth at a fine enough scale to allow this beam to propagate from one region to another without coupling problems is not trivial to do. There are some plane propagation problems that have to be resolved. It's not a bad approach, but I don't think it's the best one. The one we like best is selective area epitaxy. Now, this has the same problem in that it involves multiple growths, but the waveguide that is formed, the optical portion of this, is only grown once. And there are some other things that are done that are more complex but aren't directly related to the optical path. So let me tell you what we've done. This is an example purely for tutorial reasons, although we also did it to develop some models for this process. This is not a practical way of doing selective area epitaxy, but it's one to learn about the process. Basically, selective area epitaxy relies on the fact that during MOCVD growth, no deposition will take place on a silicon dioxide mask. That is, for all of the materials we're familiar with except for the aluminum compounds. Aluminum compounds will deposit on a silicon dioxide mask, but indium phosphide, gallium arsenide, any of the three phis, the conventional three phis that do not contain aluminum will not deposit on the oxide. As a result, this is a gas phase process and we're not changing anything except the patterning of the surface. So the input remains the same. We still have a conservation law to deal with. So in addition to having no growth on the mask, we also have a greatly enhanced growth at any place that is open because we still have to account for all the material that is brought into the system. We can describe this sort of the physics of what's going on a local scale the following way. This is a cross-section at a magnification. Basically, we're talking about a gallium arsenide or some other 3-5 surface. We've done this in many different systems. It works in lots of systems. You put a silicon dioxide mask in here, as we've shown there before. Certain things we know must be true. There's going to be a boundary layer in the gas phase, and the input concentrations will be constant across that boundary layer. We can define a unit cell that's large enough that if we're far enough away from the stripe region that the slopes in this direction will be zero. There's no net transfer. That's a force on us to define the cell correctly. Where the mask is, there's no growth, so the concentration floats, but the slope of the concentration has to be zero because there's no deposition. And then within the stripe, there is now a new deposition rate, and it's also a function of position depending on the geometry here. And what we've done is we've done two-dimensional simulation tools and so on specifically to compute what goes on in this region. So of course we make the mesh tighter here. We spend more calculation time and power in this region here and less in the regions where it's less important. The purpose of this is twofold, to understand the process and use a simple structure to tie experimental data to a model. So so that you can then turn around and use this for more complex structures. The results, the output of this, and if you do a reality check first on the left, these are the concentration profiles, and the lines, as you can see, is light here, are iso concentration profiles, and you see what you'd expect, and that's the concentration is uniform at the top, but then developing down towards where the sink is, which is the stripe opening in the center. These are fairly wide stripes that we profile anywhere from 25 to 150 microns wide, and so what you see inside the stripe then, this is the slope or the growth rate, that's what the thickness profile will look like. See these huge wings on the side because there's a huge influx of constituents from the side, and you see a bowing. The shape of the bowing is going to be affected by the diffusion lengths of the species involved, and I can tell you that it's all the column 3 species that define this. What you can't see from such a curve here is that the base growth rate is much lower. If there were no masking at all, the growth rate would be here. So the growth rate everywhere is enhanced, but particularly at the wings. So we've grown structures and compared them experimentally to the model. And this was not done a priori. The whole point of this is by doing a multiple stripe at the same time, you must be able to come up with a self-consistent set of parameters that relate the growth process to the reactor parameters that you can't normally measure diffusion lengths. We know what they should be in terms of order of magnitude, but not explicitly reaction rates, boundary layer heights, and so on. But you don't need that. If you find two places and you find those, there's only two parameters in here, so if you find two stripe widths and adjust those parameters to fit those two stripe widths, it ought to fit every other case, and that's what we found out. And here's an example of the model data, which is dashed. The slope is crooked on the side because of the finite mesh size. And then surface profile data of actual samples. This structure, as I said, is not a practical structure except for understanding the process. The growth rate enhancement is way too large. It can be 50 or 100 times, much too large. And the bowing is unacceptable. You can't have an aspect ratio of 4 or 6 to 1 height between the wings and the center and make practical devices out of it. But we were able to do these experiments and develop the model. A much effective and practical structure, in fact this is an elegant design because of its simplicity, is a dual stripe with an open field. Now we're talking about two oxide stripes with a stripe width that is much smaller, 2 to 25 microns, and a spacing between them that is only a few microns. Now the first thing we've got by having a mainly open field is we're reducing dramatically the amount of enhancement down to practical values of 1 to 3 times, which is what we want. The second thing is we define the opening, the spacing automatically defines a lateral waveguide width. So we can use this structure to create a lateral waveguide for an index-guided structure like a buried heterostructure. More importantly, that size is small compared to the diffusion length, so we should not see any of the bowing because the hole size is going to be much, much smaller than the gas phase diffusion length. Out of this structure, you get the kinds of results shown here. On the left, what we're seeing is the actual profiles. Now, this is for a 4-micron opening and two stripe widths of 6 microns, oxide stripes of 6 microns of 25 microns. For 6 microns, we see a modest growth enhancement of maybe 30%. For 25 microns, it's more like 2.6 times the base growth rate. We still see the wings off to the sides. We're going to process those out of the device. They won't matter because all the optical active part of the device will be in that center stripe region. And this appears to be flat. Actually, you'll see in the real data that it's flat. And there's a couple of reasons for that. The enhancements then can be very simply defined, calculated, and then compared to experimental results as you vary the oxide stripe width. Notice that the stripe widths here are not any particular challenge to your lithographic processes. These are fairly large on the scale of contact aligners and so on. So making 5.5 or 7.5 micron stripes with 2 or 3 micron openings is not doesn't require any special heroics in terms of lithography. We grow this. It turns out that we started doing this grow structure because of the problem with aluminum being non-selective. But it also turns out that you would want to do it this way no matter what your material system was. And then we and many others have subsequently grown using the same sort of three-step process. We start by growing the lower part of a laser structure, laser waveguide, grow a buffer layer and some aluminum gallium arsenide, maybe a micron or so, and then grow a tiny amount of gallium arsenide to seal that up, take it out of the system and process it to the dual stripes. Then you grow, in this particular case, an indium gallium arsenide active layer selectively, so that we have a quantum well that has a thickness that depends on the base thickness and composition, but amplified by the selective area width of the oxide stripes. So if you start off with a base quantum well of maybe 40 or 50 angstroms, you have a range then of from the base 40 angstroms to maybe 125 or 130 angstroms quantum well. This is a huge range in energy, which you'll see in a moment. After that's grown selectively, then we remove the oxide, return it to the reactor, and grow the rest of the structure. We form the buried heterostructure. This region outside the center stripe has no quantum well in it at all, and the gallium arsenide is fairly thin. So there's a very effective lateral index step between this region, the center, and the region, the outside. And the wings on the outside are going to be masked out, so there won't be any current flow in that region anyway. That's of no consequence. One of these structures looks like this. As you can see, it looks flat. There's a couple of reasons why it should be flat. First of all, the model says that the amount of bowing should be nearly too small to measure in any case. But gallium arsenide, indium gallium arsenide, when raised to an elevated temperature in a reactor prior to the growth of the next layers, there can be some solid phase mass transfer that goes on that would tend to smooth that out. We don't know which is which or care. The end result is that the stripe region is clearly flat and uniform. The emission from these apertures is all uniform. Laser characteristics of a simple buried heterostructure with cleave facets are excellent. These things can have thresholds as low as a few milliamps without coatings, and then when you put the coatings on, you can bring those thresholds down below a milliamp if you like. Lots of power. These are typical indium gallium arsenide strain layer lasers. They're very high performance devices. The reason to do it, there's other ways to make buried heterostructures or ridge waveguides that are probably better and certainly easier. But this is the part that you can't do unless you use a selective area epitaxy. On the left, this is the emission wavelength versus oxide stripe width for a series of lasers all grown on one wafer. The only thing that has been varied is the oxide stripe width. So these are adjacent lasers on the same wafer, one growth, one wafer. And the squares correspond to the different stripe widths that we had on the mask. The line, the dashed line that we have is not just a curve fit. This is what you would expect from the growth rate enhancement, from the growth model, as well as the quantum size effect and so on. So it's a very predictable process. And it's a huge wavelength range from 9600 to 960 to 1060 nanometers. And all these devices had similar performance characteristics. On a finer scale, you see this blue line over here. This corresponds to a second experiment we did where we varied the stripe width now by a half micron steps from 5.5 to 10.5 microns and made a series of adjacent emitters all growing at the same time. And the half micron steps correspond to about a 2 nanometer step in wavelength, and you can see that the same sort of thing, the variation in wavelength versus versus element number as we go along these stripe widths. I want you to think that this only works at gallium arsenide, or that we're the only ones working on it. There's a lot of groups working on this, and this is some data I got from Aoki, who was gracious enough to send me this electronic version of this data. This is the same kind of work done in the indium phosphide system, same dual stripe pattern here. This is a oxide stripe width in the same range. This is the emission wavelength varying from 1450 to about 1575. Same sort of comparable wavelength range for the same stripes. What he has is PL intensity and half width down below, showing how basically these materials are also uniform, as we've observed too. So, well, you can start to talk about ways of doing engineering in the optical path. You have the basic building block is this buried heterostructure, which is a good high-performance waveguide, as well as a gain region done correctly. So you can envision various structures, and these are all cartoons, although the top one has been made for a couple of different variants of this device. You can imagine having the oxide stripe be fairly wide at one point, so your growth enhancement would be the largest, and that would be your laser region. You could let the oxide stripe narrow down. That would shift the transition energy to make this region transparent. And then you could adjust it just slightly to just blue shift this region and use that as a modulator that would be transparent at zero bias, and then put a little bit of bias on it to shut off the light. What schemes you use are limited by your imagination. They could be shaped in any way that you want. There's some limitations there because of the gas phase processes. So these things are not abrupt, and changing in this way is not necessarily going to yield something that's important. And it's not half of the problem. It's half of the problem as I defined it for today, but half of these two basic problems. At least it seems clear that the selective area epitaxy offers a partial solution to one of the problems. The other half of the problem is, supposing you can make this thing with the optical path adjusted any way you like, how are you going to make the laser into a resonator and then still couple light off into the rest of this path for whatever functionality you want? Well, as I said, for 30 years we've been using etched facets and taking advantage of Mother Nature, building these crystal planes that are nearly perfectly parallel. And obviously there have been lots and lots of diodes still made that way, and it's pretty convenient. There's some problems with that. They're not particularly manufacturable because cleave facets require that you do die separation and some form of die attach to even test them. IBM did some work years ago on making wafer scale testing, because just the ability to test these wafers prior to investing all that labor into separation and attachment is of economic importance. So if you can't do cleave facets, maybe you can etch them. And there are lots of examples of etched Fabry Perot facets. The best that you can hope for is that they'll approach the cleave facets, because etching processes are less perfect, and they require some attention to the lithography for the mask that you use to define the etching, and then requires that you understand your etch process enough to make sure that the walls are as vertical as possible, so that there's not scattering in directions that are undesirable, and so on. It's been done. It complicates the coating if you want to use facet coatings, but it can be done. There's still a fundamental problem with etched facets in terms of integrated devices, because in terms of the laser anyway, because you're going to define the resonator with etching with a semiconductor air interface. That means you're taking the light out of the wafer even if locally, and you want to put it back into the wafer, you have to couple that light back into the waveguide in some manner. It can be done. There are some compound cavity effects that are problems and so on. There's work done here in lots of places on using corner reflectors and the ring geometries and so on. This is an SEM of a structure that one of my former students made some years ago. And basically, there's two steps here. One is to define the waveguide, which is a ridge waveguide, and the other is to do a more deeply etched corner reflector here. Involves the total internal reflection. You gain some advantages from these structures because, in addition, you have the same problems with verticality and so on that you have with etched Fabry Perots, but because you're coming in at an angle, you gain something from the total internal reflection. I'm not a big fan of even though we did this work on ring lasers, I'm not a big fan of ring lasers because it seems to me that there are some nice features about ring lasers as long as you don't take any light out of them. And eventually the efficiencies go way up, but that's because you're not taking any light out of them. And when you go to take light out of them, it works to your disadvantage. So we're not, haven't been really working on those. There's a huge amount of a body of information about distributed feedback lasers that are used in telecommunications. This is a case where you build a grating in along and usually above the active region of a laser in the active portion of the laser, and then defeat the reflections from the ends and use this to give you some frequency selection as well. A variation on that that I think gives us some opportunities in terms of processing as well as some other advantages is a distributed Bragg reflector. It works the same way in some sense in that you're forming a grating at the that has a period corresponding to the wavelength in the material. But by putting a Bragg grating on the ends instead of in the active region, you can separate them. It gives you some opportunities, and I'll show you what I mean. Here's the basics. Maybe Peter Zori was here last year. I think he was a distinguished lecturer last year. Perhaps you've seen his talk on some of these structures without the reflectors. What we do is we take and we use a variation on a conventional separate confinement laser and make the upper P layer a little bit thinner. And if you're judicious in your choice of metals and how you apply them, even though some of the optical field propagates up in this region, it's not a problem. There's only a small amount of additional loss. But then we come in from the top and etch a grating using dry processing and anisotropic etch, similar to some of the work here, and form a grating on the end of the laser rather than along the active length. In this example, we use a cleave facet, but that doesn't have to be. You could have two gratings on there, and there's actually some advantages of that. Lots of things we found out about this to our advantage. The first is that by putting it off to the side, you can separately contact that, put a different electrode on there, and use that to impress a current on the tuning region, on the grating, and use that as a tuning element. So as a part of the laser structure, you gain access to this, and you can increase the functionality by adding the ability to tune. There are some other advantages, some of which were completely unexpected. But here's an example of we've made this takes some heroics at about a micron, and this is at this point not what anybody would say is a manufacturable process because we're writing the gratings in our laboratory with E-beam lithography and then doing reactive ion etching. There are other ways to approach this, but for now, this gives us the most flexibility. These things have the LIs that you can see are decent, but the powers are lower. Very narrow line width. We'll talk about this again in a minute, surprisingly so. But the thresholds can be, for these lasers, can be in the below 10 milliamps. Here's an example of the first order gratings. There's a lot of data here, but the most important thing is here are all 6, 7, 8, 9 milliamps for these lasers. And by changing the grating period slightly, you can build multiple color sources, and these are all within the gain width. gain bandwidth. I also have already been yelled at about how the red ought to be on the long wavelength side. But if you've ever made these kinds of slides, I'm not changing it. Okay. So red's on the short wavelength side, but you can just pretend like it's like that and it'll be okay. All right. The two parts of it that are very interesting to us, and in fact have opened up some other applications that were unexpected. The tunability gives us a wide range to work with. You can see these are going from 1008 to 1016 nanometers by putting a current in. The mechanism here is carrier heating, so it's not fast. You couldn't use this for some kind of an FSK application, but to zero in and lock on a wavelength, you could. The real surprise is that these deep gratings are yielding very narrow line width lasers. The laser line width from these lasers is in the vicinity of 40 kilohertz, and depending on the power level and so on. This has opened up for us a whole new area of application involving remote optical sensing of molecular species, water vapor, and so on. Because now the laser line width is narrow enough that you can tell when you're on or off the absorption. So what I'd like to do now is talk about how you could use these one or the other, or in some cases both of these technologies, to get more photonic functionality out of some devices. So I'll talk about several variations of laser modulator structures, a laser photodiode that was designed to be a four-terminal device, and a redundant source, and then an eight-channel transmitter. Some of this work was done at Illinois, lots of it was done elsewhere. Is, again, Aoki gave me this data. This is a laser modulator. Same sort of approach was used for the growth. This is done at 1.5 microns. The only real difference in this structure is sort of interesting, is that they only grew the laser region selectively. They left the broad area growth. They didn't define the waveguide the whole length of the device the way we do. They allow this device to open up and use a different form of waveguide that was compatible with their existing processes, and only use the selective growth process to grow the actual laser region of this laser modulator. So by definition, this is thicker, and then this is blue shifted, and so their laser the modulator is transparent at the operating wavelength at zero bias, and the rest of these steps are the processing that go along with that. Tali Tombanek at Bell Labs, or whatever they are now, sent me this slide, and I have to apologize to him and to you. I have a number of figures that I got. I contacted all of the authors. All of them very quickly and graciously sent me electronic versions of their data so I could incorporate into slides, which I was not able to do because I don't know how to do it. So these ended up being scanned images anyway from the journal, so that's why they don't look very good. Tali did a similar thing, and the structure looks almost the same as the one of Aoki. Same thing, they use a silicon dioxide mask to selectively define the laser region and let the field open up for this. There's his emission wavelengths, his function stripe width. This is all very comparable. We did ours a little bit. We grew both the laser and the modulator selectively. And because I'm talking about my data now, I have really good figures for this. This is my Macintosh. The structure is growing the same way with a couple of things. One, we've included the selective epi to blue shift the modulator region. But also, we've adjusted this grading. One of the neat things about this grading is that you can adjust the number of periods in the depth to give you some, however much effective reflectivity you think you need for a particular structure. In this case, we knew we were talking about a two-element device. We can put a coating on the back here. We don't need that much reflectivity. In fact, we want usable power, so we diminish the grating effect. We still get the wavelength selectivity that comes from it automatically. And here's a top surface view and the laser region and the modulator region over here. Characteristics of this device. Thresholds of 10 milliamps or less, very narrow line with the laser emission, and This is a free space measurement of the modulation where you see about 20 dB of extinction at a volt or so. It turns out that when you do this more carefully and couple a light into a fiber so you're not getting scattered light from the grating in other places, that the extinction ratios go up for the same voltage range. But basically, you have a device that you can turn on and off at a volt or a little bit less than that. And this has also been done by Cotto et al. And again, same thing. He sent me his figures and I screwed them up, so this is a scanned image. Done very similar. Instead of the grating being using a grating, a DBR grating to define his laser, he's using a DFB laser by forming a grating and then doing the selective growth to make the waveguide region getting the transition. The grating is below the laser, then using selective to change the wavelength along the optical path. But he's done what we do, where the optical path is completely defined and essentially uninterrupted because you continue to stripe the whole length of the device. A hero experiment we did as a collaboration with somebody else who was interested in the possibility of making an optical read-write that would flip chip onto a silicon microprocessor and allow the microprocessor to talk to a RAM cache or something like that using photons instead of electrical connections. So the requirements were that we make a laser photodiode combination, and further that it had, in order to flip chip it, that it had to be perfectly isolated and all the contacts on the top. On the normal, as you know, for most optical devices, we usually make use of the substrates when we can as one of the contacts. So in this case, we had to use a semi-insulating gallium arsenide substrate. We grew the laser diode region in the photodiode, and this time changed the oxide stripes to redshifted so it would be more absorbing at zero bias. And we used an etched facet here for several reasons. One was to increase the isolation. These are very highly isolated devices. And then also to allow us to etch the input facet for the photodetector, since signal power was never much of an issue, to tilt it to avoid a compound cavity effect, minimize the amount of light that might be coupled from the input facet of the detector back into the laser region. Then we had to put in additional steps in here to get access to the lower n-type material for the n-type contacts. It would be all, so we had the four contacts all on the top surface. And the laser diode and the photodiode output, zero bias, shown here, good threshold characteristics for the laser. And as you vary the angle from 3 degrees to 45 degrees, of course you defeat the amount of coupling, increase the isolation from the detector in the laser, but you do that at your peril because you decrease the power at any given point. This dual source, which is how we designed it originally, although you could certainly use this structure as a redundant source too if you had some hazardous environment or a remote location you wanted to have a backup laser source. And it was made using selective epi. And this, the reason I'm introducing this is because it includes a Y coupler. We use selective epi to form the two laser regions with two different wavelengths here. Okay. In this case, I was careful and used the red for the longer wavelength. Okay. And of course, neither of them are red or blue. They're both in the infrared. We made modulator sections, as I described earlier, but without the gratings. Couple these into a transparent waveguide that's a shallow angle, comes to a Y, and joins. The resonator is between this cleave facet and the back cleave facets, which can be coated. Each one has a part of the resonator is common to both of them. Of course, so is the splitter, so there's some light from either side going, coupling back into both sides. Nevertheless, these are still very low threshold lasers, again, a few milliamps, 10 milliamps or so, perfectly acceptable efficiency. But the way the modulator work is, this is a negative logic. So when the modulator is on, basically the light is off. So we apply a voltage over here, then it only leaves one source on. If we apply the voltage over here, it only leaves the other source on. And if you apply no modulator voltage bias on either, you get two laser lines out of here at the same time. How close together these could be, we don't know. There is some pumping that goes on from one side to the other, and so they're not completely independent of each other. On the other hand, for lots of applications, it doesn't matter that they be, first of all. Secondly, if that was a critical issue, you could easily build in these DBRs in here and use that to give you the isolation that you're needing. A little bit about Chuck Joyner's 8-channel transmitter, because he did some clever things here with selective area epitaxy. This is a little bit, if you've never seen this structure before, I know I saw some gratings where this kind of a grating structure was used here at, I believe, formed in oxides. This is done in a semiconductor. The cavity, the resonant cavity, starts here with an HR coating where there's a region of gain, broadband gain, goes through this grating free space coupling region into the grating where the path length difference defines the wavelength back and recoupled into a series of points, each one going to a gain region. All of these were formed selectively so that they have different peak wavelengths. So the gain path is from here through one of these, depending on the wavelength, back and forth like that. Then what he did was he coupled the second order mode, which is pretty unavoidable, out to use that as a usable power. So the output here comes through a modulator and does so at no penalty. Cue that selective area epitaxy is a viable technology for choosing the emission wavelength or the transition energy wherever you want it within some limits on a wafer. That the DBR reflector, I'm convinced, is an important, not ideal, but nearly so, component for including these integrated photonic devices. And there are lots of examples of ways where these different kinds of technologies have been coupled together to form some working devices. Thank you.
Any questions?